Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Dr. Martha Crenshaw is a senior fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spolio Institute for International Studies and with the Center for International Security and Cooperation at the University of Texas, and she is an expert on terrorism. And while the attacks of 9/11 made all Americans experts on terrorism in a certain way, Dr. Crenshaw says there's more to learn about them, including the various ways governments have responded to terrorist attacks and what the results have been. Dr. Crenshaw, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry I couldn't be at the university in person due to the snowstorm, but I'm glad I can talk to you by radio at least.
Well, it's good to have you. I hope the weather is nicer where you are.
It is nicer in California, and I have to say that my appointment is exclusively at Stanford. I don't have a connection to the University of Texas.
Okay. I don't know why I have that in there. Thank you for the correction. Maybe just for starters, because I think even this has been a bone of contention, do we even have, of everybody who's arguing about terrorism and terrorist organizations, a common definition of those two words?
Well, defining terrorism has always been an enormous problem because it tends to be a very subjective matter for different people. And typically, people don't want to call groups that they feel friendly toward terrorists. They would rather reserve that term for their enemies. I myself, as an academic, try to use the term neutrally to refer to forms of violence that are intended to shock and directed against symbolic targets, usually civilian targets, not intended to defeat the enemy militarily. It's a form of conspiratorial or clandestine violence. But it is indeed a very contentious subject, and in fact so contentious, I think, that the U.S. government has taken to calling it violent extremism rather than terrorism.
Okay, so let me make sure we have a bead on some of the things you just said. Attacks which are meant to shock, to have a symbolic value, they may use civilian targets and not targets which would be the ones you would aim at for bringing down a government or bringing down the military capability of an army. So they're not intended to work towards defeat, at least not by themselves.
They have more of a psychological effect than a directly material or a military effect. And in fact, terrorism is a sort of tactic or strategy which permits an adversary to bypass engagement with the enemy's armed forces entirely. You don't even need to attack your enemy's army in order to use terrorism against them. You can attack diplomats, you can attack tourists, you can attack airliners. It's a way, in many ways, of bypassing the armed defenses of an adversary.
Well, that brings up another question. When we say a terrorist organization, since this is a tactic, it's not the goal, I assume, of an organization. Are we muddying the waters when we say terrorist organization?
Well, the term terrorist organization is problematic in that sense because it implies that the group in question only uses terrorism. And many groups that the United States government, for example, puts on its list of terrorist organizations actually do other things as well. Hezbollah in Lebanon is a prime example. However, this is not to say that there have not been groups that focused exclusively on terrorism and didn't appear to have much in the way of another goal. An example there is a group that, from the past, a Palestinian group called the Abu Nidal Organization. And this was an extremely cult-like group centered around the charismatic personality of Abu Nidal, exactly. And they appeared really not to have much beyond simply using terrorism against primarily Israeli but also European and American targets. They didn't have much of a political program at all. But I think that's probably exceptional. Most groups do have a political program, and terrorism is only one of the means that they use.
Well, we welcome you to our conversation with Professor Crenshaw as well. You can join us on the air by calling 333-9455 or toll-free at 800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL, 800-222-WYLL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And Professor Crenshaw, you were going to give a talk yesterday, and the title of that talk, if I have it here in front of me, was Responding to Global Terrorism, Provocation, Retaliation, and Deterrence. Are those three are those three about responses, or are those about something else?
Well, what I would have focused on in my talk, if I had been able to get to Champaign-Urbana, was the way in which terrorism provokes states. It's a very provocative sort of challenge to states. And then how do states respond to provocations? And in particular, how credible are threats of retaliation against these groups who are primarily non-state actors? And what I discovered in my research is that although all terrorism is provocative to a certain extent, the number of attacks that are highly provocative, actually, it's a fairly small number given the range of how many terrorist attacks there are overall. So I focused on those particular types of attacks, such as attacks on a country's homeland, like the 911 attacks. There have been several others of those that we can talk about if the listeners would like to. And I said, well, how do states respond when it's a really extremely provocative terrorist attack? And I found that actually that military retaliation was very rare, although some people seem to think in the post-911 world that it's very common. It actually isn't when you look at the facts. And so I sort of then said, well, why don't states retaliate against these groups? If there are limits to the effectiveness of retaliation, then how effective is it to threaten a group that you're going to retaliate when they might know full well that there are too many constraints on your ability to retaliate for what they do, and therefore they're not affected at all by your threats? So, for example, one of the things that stops states from retaliating is the attribution problem. This was true, for example, after the assassination or murder of Ambassador Stevens in Libya. We just couldn't figure out who did it in a timely and extremely convincing way, and it's hard to retaliate when you're not sure who did it.
On the other hand, I guess the U.S. has gone in the two countries, Iraq and Afghanistan. Really, in Afghanistan, I guess, would really be the example of going after terrorists there. In Iraq, we seem to have maybe more inspired terrorist attacks by going into there looking for weapons of mass destruction and overthrowing the Saddam Hussein government.
Well, that's certainly true. And the case of Afghanistan is very interesting because, yes, we were responding to an enormous provocation, the greatest provocation that has ever occurred, and with any luck will not happen again, the 911 attacks. But if you look at the record, you have to go back at least to 1998, if not earlier, and see that we were being challenged by al-Qaeda, and we were threatening to retaliate for 3 years at least, and we didn't. There were a series of attacks. We retaliated in 1998, but we did not retaliate for the USS Cole. We kept telling the Taliban that they had to turn over bin Laden or we would do something, but we didn't. We didn't retaliate for the Millennium Plots. Some of us will remember those. It was an attempt to bomb Los Angeles International Airport, various plots. There was an attack in Jordan. So there was a series of threats that we actually did not carry out until finally the provocation was so immense that we did attack in order to drive bin Laden out of Afghanistan, but actually, of course, what we wound up doing was driving him into Pakistan, and it took us another 10 years to remove him from the scene there. The case of Iraq, there were claims at the time that Saddam Hussein had connections to al-Qaeda, but these were simply false. The connection was not there, and of course, the main reason for invading Iraq was the purported weapons of mass destruction that he was supposed to have had. And as you say, all we did there was create a space for al-Qaeda to rebuild in the heart of the Middle East.
Well, we have some patient callers standing by, and I want to say hello to Peter in Chicago. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes, good morning. I've got a couple questions. I'm not sure they're necessarily connected, but I think they are. I'm wondering, one, if the use of the word terrorism is just an example of an attempt on the part of a government to denigrate its adversaries because of such a loose definition that we seem to be using, and also whether the professor would consider activities such as the old Italian Red Brigades as terrorist act, or the Basque, or more in a more contemporary sense, the U.S. use of drones as terrorist activity. And I'll wait for the answer.
Thank you very much. And Professor Crenshaw, let's start with the first part of that question. And the word terror, is that a provocative word in itself? Is it a propaganda word, or is it a descriptive word?
Well, as I said earlier, it tends to be extremely contentious, and certainly it can be used in an extremely derogatory way. However, it's important to remember that some revolutionary movements in the past were extremely proud to call themselves terrorists. For example, the Russian Revolutionary Movement, they regarded being called a terrorist as a badge of honor, and they proudly called themselves terrorists. And indeed, they were one of the first groups to say, yes, what we're using is terrorism, and we are terrorists. The origin of the term lies with the French Revolution. Some governments, of course, have used the term terrorist to try to condemn their enemies. South Africa would be a primary example, also the Nazi regime, who called most of the French resistance terrorists, leading a member of the French resistance to write a book saying, which was called, my translation into English, We the Terrorist, quite proudly. So the term is also used back by the people who are called terrorists in a way against the government. So, yeah, there can be that element to it. I myself, as I say, I try to use the term in a neutral way. And the problem is we can't get away from using that word. So my feeling was always that you could struggle like I do to use it in a neutral and objective way and to ensure that others do as well, or you could just abandon the field and let other people use it as they like and you use something different. And as I say, the Obama administration, indeed the late Bush administration, has switched to the use of the term violent extremism rather than terrorism.
I have a memory of reading about World War II, in which I believe the Allied powers were bombing civilian areas, I think in German cities, and openly using the word terror, as in terror bombings, as is that was the actual intent of those bombings. Is that similar to what is called terrorism today, or is that something different?
Well, from an academic perspective, an analytical perspective, you would want to distinguish between a state of terror and terrorism, the deliberate intent to inflict possibly terror on the adversary, but not necessarily. As I say, what I focus on in my work is clandestine political violence, conspiratorial political violence by non-state actors. And some people focus on states, and they wish to call the state a terrorist, and they study, in effect, what we might call oppressive behavior as terrorism. For myself, I like to use the term terrorism for conspiratorial violence and regime of terror for terror from above by the state. This is not to say that states sometimes don't mimic small conspiratorial organizations in their use of violence. Now, remember, when you talk about regimes of terror or inflicting terror by, for example, strategic bombing at the time, remember that during the Cold War we lived in a balance of terror as each superpower tried to, in effect, preserve a state of mutual deterrence through mutual assured destruction. So the notion of terror being inflicted by the state from above to either force an adversary into submission by attacking civilian populations or threatening to attack civilian populations in order to prevent the other side from attacking. This is also quite common as a phenomenon. And so there's a resemblance, but it's sort of at a higher level of abstraction. So, as I say, what I'm more interested in is small groups and conspiratorial violence, but you can certainly look at terror and terrorism from other sources and in other ways.
Well, getting back to Peter's call when he brought up the Red Brigade and Basque separatists, are these terror organizations? Are these organizations which have used terrorism?
These absolutely are groups that have used terrorism. I can give you quite a long list going back to the 19th century. We would say the Russian Revolutionary Movement, particularly Narodnaya Volya, or the People's Will, the anarchist movement, and the early Irish Republican movement, the beginnings of revolutionary terrorism.
And then the next step that Peter brought up, and that was the use of drones by the United States. Terrorism or something else?
Well, what I'm more interested in is this a form of retaliation for terrorism? I don't think that they are primarily intended to terrorize a population. I think they're intended to be an effective military tool of removing usually individual people who are regarded as quite dangerous. Whether or not they then have a symbolic psychological effect on other people, that's something certainly that that we could talk about, because we're going to be in a world of drones. I myself, and obviously we don't know a lot, because we don't know a lot about the reasons for the targeting behind the drones. We all know this has been a large public debate. So it's hard for us to tell what the purpose is, other than the stated purpose, which is to remove people who are clear and imminent dangers to our national security. So this is the way the tactic is explained to us. I have noted, however, in looking at the drone strikes, that sometimes the people who have been targeted are people who were responsible for earlier acts of terrorism against the U.S. or against our allies. And I myself, I don't know, is that retaliation for what they did before? We're simply getting even? Or is it because they're still out there and they're still dangerous and we needed to remove them from the scene? But we don't, as I say, we don't have a good decision-making trail in the case of the drones.
Well, this is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking to political science professor Martha Crenshaw of Stanford University. She's an expert on terrorism, and the weather kept her from visiting the University of Illinois yesterday to give a talk here, but she's still our guest on Focus for this hour. And Professor Crenshaw, I was wondering then, you mentioned just a few minutes back and concerning the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, in which Ambassador Chris Stevens was killed, how the U.S. response was seen as sort of indecisive because we simply had trouble figuring out who did it, is what it came down to. And I'm wondering, does that happen? Is that a common problem with terrorist attacks?
It's a very common problem because, of course, one of the reasons that a group uses terrorism is often to try to avoid a responsibility. It can be a form of deception because you figure nobody's going to be able to trace your connection to it. Sometimes terrorists or groups that are using terrorism claim credit. They very proudly claim credit. Sometimes there are multiple claims of credit. Other times they deny that they ever did it. So it can be a very slippery and elusive thing. And I'll just give you another example that was a very difficult issue for the United States, and this is the bombing of Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia in 1996. This is American military barracks supporting the no-fly zone over Iraq at that time. And there was a major bombing. A number of people were killed. And it was a military target, but clearly it was a very symbolic attack. And the United States and Saudi Arabia were pretty sure that Iran was behind it, but they couldn't prove that Iran was behind it. And Saudi Arabia was very reluctant to let the United States investigate who was behind it. And by the time Louis Freeh and the Department of Justice and the FBI had felt that they had, you know, pretty conclusive evidence, a long time had passed, and it didn't seem really appropriate to do, you know, it was almost too late to act. And by that time, there'd been sort of a what we thought at the time was a softening of the regime in Iran. We didn't really want to go punishing them. They were uncooperative. So the whole thing just faded away because we were unable to in effect, to have a timely attribution of who did it. And in my view, it has to be timely. It can't be years later. And second, it has to be a credible sort of claim. It has to hold up in the eyes of one's own domestic public and in the eyes of the world that, in effect, that particularly when a state is involved, that they are indeed responsible. And these are very, very high standards to meet.
Does a terrorist organization benefit if a country that was targeted attempts quick retaliation and makes a mistake? And on the other hand, do they not benefit so much if a country holds back in some cases?
Well, you certainly could argue that if you retaliate very quickly in haste, and particularly if you then respond indiscriminately, you kill a lot of people who had nothing to do with it, then certainly you've probably played into their hands, because even though they rarely admit that it's a strategy of provocation, of course, can be very profitable for them as we alienate population, for example. And in some cases, simply a policy of restraint would be better. And what you find, and I've surveyed these cases since the end of the Cold War, is that in most cases, governments find other ways of responding when this is an enormously provocative attack. For example, actually, simple law enforcement is actually the most common response, in a sense that they simply try to go through legal channels at home and abroad to find out who did it, catch them eventually. Might take years, and bring them back and put them on trial. Often governments change their laws at home, often to criminalize more facets of terrorist activity, various conspiratorial activities, possession of firearms. In the United States, material support for terrorism. In other words, they increase their abilities in terms of just domestic law enforcement to deal with the issue rather than trying to retaliate through some sort of coercive or a military means. Now, these kinds of measures can be extremely severe. For example, a common response is to put a group on a list of terrorist organizations. This then comports automatic sanctions that prevents them from raising money in your country, for example, among a diaspora population. So non-military responses can still be quite punitive and less risky for the state.
Let's go over to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus with Martha Crenshaw.
Good morning. Yeah, state terror was one of the topics I wanted you to address, and you've already talked about how you that's not your specialty. But I wanted to point out that our state terrorist, Efren Rios Montt in Guatemala, is actually on trial. Apparently, it's the first time a general, and he was also president for a while, first time a president of a country is being adjudicated in his own country. And it's a credit to the stalwart Mayans who were genocidally attacked by state terror. But I wanted to ask you about whether you've looked into this, I think, the case of Tale of Two Terrorist Organizations, and that would be the PKK and the PJAC, which variously the latter is PJAK or PEJAK. They're both Kurds. They have pretty much been accepted, even in the New York Times, that they have a unified command. And they're both on the terrorist list. But the U.S., in the last year of the Bush administration, put a bunch of money into destabilizing Iran, and including money going to PJAC and Jandala, Pakistan, and the Baluchistan region. focusing on the Kurds, you know, we have the good Kurds and the bad Kurds. The PKK, who've been attacking Turkey, there's been a ceasefire of sorts just recently, but PJAC, there's allegations that there's still collusion going on. And so the U.S. is, the big distinction is that the PJAC is attacking Iran and PKK is attacking Turkey and allies. So I just I want to bring that up just as a general idea for people to dwell on and see what you think about it, how you can respond to this very blatantly politicized use of the term in policy and de facto aiding one and fighting the other drastically during the Clinton administration, and PKK was just obliterated in eastern Turkey. I guess I should let you respond. I'm afraid I could keep going for a while.
Dr. Crenshaw, these two different Kurdish factions?
Well, there's a lot to talk about in the questions. Those are very, very good questions, so let me just hit some parts of it. One, the foreign terrorist organization list and the arbitrariness sometimes of which groups are on the list and which aren't. That's certainly true. That's a highly politicized list. And in my own research, when I'm trying to identify groups that use terrorism for my own analysis, I would never use that list. Because the choice of who gets on that list is just too political. And so I would myself would use quite different and open standards that I hope would be defensible in analytical or theoretical terms. So, yes, the FTO lists are extremely politicized and arbitrary. They differ from country to country. The U.S. differs from the EU. The Russians have a list. The Chinese have a list. The UN has a list. We have a list. We have a list of groups, and we have a list of individuals. So it all gets to be extremely complicated. And groups get on it. Sometimes the groups get on it because the government in question, say Turkey, pressures the U.S. to put them on the list. Sometimes we put them on the list when they attack us. I know the State Department goes through a real process for choosing groups, but there can be all kinds of pressures. And this, think also in that same part of the world, the Mujahideen-e Khalq, the former Iranian group, who got taken off the list, although they were responsible for a lot of American deaths. So, yes, it's arbitrary. And then the notion of particularly the different Kurdish groups and the kinds of challenges they pose. And that, of course, is just a really interesting question. There are a lot of cautionary observations that we might draw about the dangers of supporting these types of groups and trying to use them for your own purposes, whether it be the United States or any other state. It is very difficult to control them. It's a very risky business. And then you get into the situation of Turkish, of course, opposition to various Kurdish claims, and in recent years, as I'm sure the caller knows, Turkey has loosened up quite a lot on its dealings with the Kurds, and part of that is because of the autonomous Kurdish zone in Iraq. Turkey wants to be very friendly with them. They have very strong economic interests with them, and so how can you deal with these Kurds are fine, but these Kurds are not fine? And then the U.S. government saying, well, these Kurds are not good because they attack Turkey, but these Kurds are good because they attack Iran. It's a very, very difficult game to play. And like I say, it's not just the U.S. who's tried to play this sort of game. Think of India and various Sri Lankan groups. You think of the Pakistani government and various Sunni groups, jihadist groups. It's a very complex world. From an academic point of view, it's all very interesting, but it's hard to study because this is the essence of clandestine and conspiratorial types of activities that that you don't get a whole lot of information about. And also, the world of these clandestine underground groups is like it's like a kaleidoscope. They shift all the time, and their relationships with each other and with the states that they have links to change all the time. So just from week to week, practically, allegiances may shift. It's very hard just to keep up with what's going on, much less influence what's going on.
Well, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with more about terrorism with Professor Martha Crenshaw. This is Focus on WYLL. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Dr. Martha Crenshaw is a senior fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spolio Institute for International Studies and with the Center for International Security and Cooperation at the University of Texas, and she is an expert on terrorism. And while the attacks of 9/11 made all Americans experts on terrorism in a certain way, Dr. Crenshaw says there's more to learn about them, including the various ways governments have responded to terrorist attacks and what the results have been. Dr. Crenshaw, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry I couldn't be at the university in person due to the snowstorm, but I'm glad I can talk to you by radio at least.
Well, it's good to have you. I hope the weather is nicer where you are.
It is nicer in California, and I have to say that my appointment is exclusively at Stanford. I don't have a connection to the University of Texas.
Okay. I don't know why I have that in there. Thank you for the correction. Maybe just for starters, because I think even this has been a bone of contention, do we even have, of everybody who's arguing about terrorism and terrorist organizations, a common definition of those two words?
Well, defining terrorism has always been an enormous problem because it tends to be a very subjective matter for different people. And typically, people don't want to call groups that they feel friendly toward terrorists. They would rather reserve that term for their enemies. I myself, as an academic, try to use the term neutrally to refer to forms of violence that are intended to shock and directed against symbolic targets, usually civilian targets, not intended to defeat the enemy militarily. It's a form of conspiratorial or clandestine violence. But it is indeed a very contentious subject, and in fact so contentious, I think, that the U.S. government has taken to calling it violent extremism rather than terrorism.
Okay, so let me make sure we have a bead on some of the things you just said. Attacks which are meant to shock, to have a symbolic value, they may use civilian targets, and not targets which would be the ones you would aim at for bringing down a government or bringing down the military capability of an army. So they're not intended to work towards defeat, at least not by themselves.
They have more of a psychological effect than a directly material or a military effect. And in fact, terrorism is a sort of tactic or strategy which permits an adversary to bypass engagement with the enemy's armed forces entirely. You don't even need to attack your enemy's army in order to use terrorism against them. You can attack diplomats, you can attack tourists, you can attack airliners. It's a way, in many ways, of bypassing the armed defenses of an adversary.
Well, that brings up another question. When we say a terrorist organization, since this is a tactic, it's not the goal, I assume, of an organization. Are we muddying the waters when we say terrorist organization?
Well, the term terrorist organization is problematic in that sense because it implies that the group in question only uses terrorism. And many groups that the United States government, for example, puts on its list of terrorist organizations actually do other things as well. Hezbollah in Lebanon is a prime example. However, this is not to say that there have not been groups that focused exclusively on terrorism and didn't appear to have much in the way of another goal. An example there is a group that, from the past, a Palestinian group called the Abu Nidal organization. And this was an extremely cult-like group centered around the charismatic personality of Abu Nidal, exactly. And they appeared really not to have much beyond simply using terrorism against primarily Israeli but also European and American targets. They didn't have much of a political program at all. But I think that's probably exceptional. Most groups do have a political program, and terrorism is only one of the means that they use.
Well, we welcome you to our conversation with Professor Crenshaw as well. You can join us on the air by calling 333-9455 or toll-free at 800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL, 800-222-WYLL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And Professor Crenshaw, you were going to give a talk yesterday, and the title of that talk, if I have it here in front of me, was Responding to Global Terrorism, Provocation, Retaliation, and Deterrence. Are those three about responses, or are those about something else?
Well, what I would have focused on in my talk, if I had been able to get to Champaign-Urbana, was the way in which terrorism provokes states. It's a very provocative sort of challenge to states. And then how do states respond to provocations? And in particular, how credible are threats of retaliation against these groups who are primarily non-state actors? And what I discovered in my research is that although all terrorism is provocative to a certain extent, the number of attacks that are highly provocative, actually, it's a fairly small number given the range of how many terrorist attacks there are overall. So I focused on those particular types of attacks, such as attacks on a country's homeland, like the 911 attacks. There have been several others of those that we can talk about if the listeners would like to. And I said, well, how do states respond when it's a really extremely provocative terrorist attack? And I found that actually that military retaliation was very rare, although some people seem to think in the post-911 world that it's very common. It actually isn't when you look at the facts. And so I sort of then said, well, why don't states retaliate against these groups? If there are limits to the effectiveness of retaliation, then how effective is it to threaten a group that you're going to retaliate when they might know full well that there are too many constraints on your ability to retaliate for what they do, and therefore they're not affected at all by your threats? So, for example, one of the things that stops states from retaliating is the attribution problem. This was true, for example, after the assassination or murder of Ambassador Stevens in Libya. We just couldn't figure out who did it in a timely and extremely convincing way, and it's hard to retaliate when you're not sure who did it.
On the other hand, I guess the U.S. has the U.S. has gone into two countries, Iraq and Afghanistan, really in Afghanistan, I guess, would really be the example of going after terrorists there. In Iraq, we seem to have maybe more inspired terrorist attacks by going into there looking for weapons of mass destruction and overthrowing the Saddam Hussein government.
Well, that's certainly true. And the case of Afghanistan is very interesting because, yes, we were responding to an enormous provocation, the greatest provocation that has ever occurred, and with any luck will not happen again, the 9/11 attacks. But if you look at the record, you have to go back at least to 1998, if not earlier, and see that we were being challenged by al-Qaeda, and we were threatening to retaliate for 3 years at least, and we didn't. There were a series of attacks. We retaliated in 1998, but we did not retaliate for the USS Cole. We kept telling the Taliban that they had to turn over bin Laden or we would do something, but we didn't. We didn't retaliate for the Millennium Plots. Some of us will remember those. It was an attempt to bomb Los Angeles International Airport, various plots. There was an attack in Jordan. So there was a series of threats that we actually did not carry out until finally the provocation was so immense that we did attack in order to drive bin Laden out of Afghanistan. But actually, of course, what we wound up doing was driving him into Pakistan, and it took us another 10 years to remove him from the scene there. The case of Iraq, there were claims at the time that Saddam Hussein had connections to al-Qaeda, but these were simply false. The connection was not there, and of course the main reason for invading Iraq was the purported weapons of mass destruction that he was supposed to have had. And as you say, all we did there was create a space for al-Qaeda to rebuild in the heart of the Middle East.
Well, we have some patient callers standing by, and I want to say hello to Peter in Chicago. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes, good morning. I've got a couple questions. I'm not sure they're necessarily connected, but I think they are. I'm wondering, one, if the use of the word terrorism is just an example of an attempt on the part of a government to denigrate its adversaries because of such a loose definition that we seem to be using. And also, whether the professor would consider activities such as the old Italian Red Brigades as terrorist act, or the Basque, or more in a more contemporary sense, the U.S. use of drones as terrorist activity. And I'll wait for the answer.
Thank you very much. And Professor Crenshaw, let's start with the first part of that question. And the word terror, is that a provocative word in itself? Is it a propaganda word, or is it a descriptive word?
Well, as I said earlier, it tends to be extremely contentious, and certainly it can be used in an extremely derogatory way. However, it's important to remember that some revolutionary movements in the past were extremely proud to call themselves terrorists. For example, the Russian Revolutionary Movement, they regarded being called a terrorist as a badge of honor, and they proudly called themselves terrorists. And indeed, they were one of the first groups to say, yes, what we're using is terrorism, and we are terrorists. The origin of the term lies with the French Revolution. Some governments, of course, have used the term terrorist to try to condemn their enemies. South Africa would be a primary example, also the Nazi regime, who called most of the French resistance terrorists, leading a member of the French resistance to write a book saying, which was called, my translation into English, We the Terrorists, quite proudly. So the term is also used back by the people who are called terrorists in a way against the government. So, there can be that element to it. I try to use the term in a neutral way. And the problem is we can't get away from using that word. So my feeling was always that you could struggle like I do to use it in a neutral and objective way and to ensure that others do as well, or you could just abandon the field and let other people use it as they like and you use something different. And as I say, the Obama administration, indeed the late Bush administration, has switched to the use of the term violent extremism rather than terrorism.
I have a memory of reading about World War II, in which I believe the Allied powers were bombing civilian areas, I think, in German cities, and openly using the word terror, as in terror bombings, as is that was the actual intent of those bombings. Is that similar to what is called terrorism today, or is that something different?
Well, from an academic perspective, an analytical perspective, you would want to distinguish between a state of terror and terrorism, the deliberate intent to inflict possibly terror on the adversary, but not necessarily. As I say, what I focus on in my work is clandestine political violence, conspiratorial political violence by non-state actors. And some people focus on states, and they wish to call the state a terrorist, and they study, in effect, what we might call oppressive behavior as terrorism. For myself, I like to use the term terrorism for conspiratorial violence and regime of terror for terror from above by the state. This is not to say that states sometimes don't mimic small conspiratorial organizations in their use of violence. Now, remember, when you talk about regimes of terror or inflicting terror by, for example, strategic bombing at the time, remember that during the Cold War we lived in a balance of terror as each superpower tried to, in effect, preserve a state of mutual deterrence through mutual assured destruction. So the notion of terror being inflicted by the state from above to either force an adversary into submission by attacking civilian populations or threatening to attack civilian populations in order to prevent the other side from attacking. This is also quite common as a phenomenon. And so there's a resemblance, but it's sort of at a higher level of abstraction. So, as I say, what I'm more interested in is small groups and conspiratorial violence, but you can certainly look at terror and terrorism from other sources and in other ways.
Well, getting back to Peter's call when he brought up the Red Brigade and Basque separatists, are these terror organizations? Are these organizations which have used terrorism?
These absolutely are groups that have used terrorism. I can give you quite a long list going back to the 19th century. We would say the Russian Revolutionary Movement, particularly Narodnaya Volya, or the People's Will, the anarchist movement, and the early Irish Republican movement, the beginnings of revolutionary terrorism.
And then the next step that Peter brought up, and that was the use of drones by the United States. Terrorism or something else?
Well, what I'm more interested in is this a form of retaliation for terrorism? I don't think that they are primarily intended to terrorize a population. I think they're intended to be an effective military tool of removing usually individual people who are regarded as quite dangerous. Whether or not they then have a symbolic psychological effect on other people, that's something certainly that that we could talk about, because we're going to be in a world of drones. I myself, and obviously we don't know a lot, because we don't know a lot about the reasons for the targeting behind the drones. We all know this has been a large public debate. So it's hard for us to tell what the purpose is, other than the stated purpose, which is to remove people who are clear and imminent dangers to our national security. So this is the way the tactic is explained to us. I have noted, however, in looking at the drone strikes, that sometimes the people who have been targeted are people who were responsible for earlier acts of terrorism against the U.S. or against our allies. And I myself, I don't know, is that retaliation for what they did before? We're simply getting even? Or is it because they're still out there and they're still dangerous, and we needed to remove them from the scene? But we don't, as I say, we don't have a good decision-making trail in the case of the drones.
Well, this is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking to political science professor Martha Crenshaw of Stanford University. She's an expert on terrorism, and the weather kept her from visiting the University of Illinois yesterday to give a talk here, but she's still our guest on Focus for this hour. And Professor Crenshaw, I was wondering then, you mentioned just a few minutes back and concerning the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, in which Ambassador Chris Stevens was killed, how the U.S. response was seen as sort of indecisive because we simply had trouble figuring out who did it, is what it came down to. And I'm wondering, does that happen? Is that a common problem with terrorist attacks?
It's a very common problem because, of course, one of the reasons that a group uses terrorism is to often to try to avoid a responsibility. It can be a form of deception because you figure nobody's going to be able to trace your connection to it. Sometimes terrorists or groups that are using terrorism claim credit. They very proudly claim credit. Sometimes there are multiple claims of credit. Other times they deny that they ever did it. So it can be a very slippery and elusive thing. And I'll just give you another example that was a very difficult issue for the United States, and this is the bombing of Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia in 1996. This is American military barracks supporting the no-fly zone over Iraq at that time. And there was a major bombing. A number of people were killed. And it was a military target, but clearly it was a very symbolic attack. And the United States and Saudi Arabia were pretty sure that Iran was behind it, but they couldn't prove that Iran was behind it. And Saudi Arabia was very reluctant to let the United States investigate who was behind it. And by the time Louis Freeh and the Department of Justice and the FBI had felt that they had, you know, pretty conclusive evidence, a long time had passed, and it didn't seem really appropriate to do, you know, it was almost too late to act. And by that time, there'd been sort of a what we thought at the time was a softening of the regime in Iran. We didn't really want to go punishing them. They were uncooperative. So the whole thing just faded away because we were unable to in effect, to have a timely attribution of who did it. And in my view, it has to be timely. It can't be years later. And second, it has to be a credible sort of claim. It has to hold up in the eyes of one's own domestic public and in the eyes of the world that, in effect, that particularly when a state is involved, that they are indeed responsible. And these are very, very high standards to meet.
Does a terrorist organization benefit if a nation, if a country or that was targeted attempts quick retaliation and makes a mistake? And on the other hand, do they not benefit so much if a country holds back in some cases?
Well, you certainly could argue that if you retaliate very quickly in haste, and particularly if you then respond indiscriminately, you kill a lot of people who had nothing to do with it, then certainly you've probably played into their hands because even though they rarely admit that it's a strategy of provocation, of course, can be very profitable for them as we alienate a population, for example. And in some cases, simply a policy of restraint would be better. And what you find, and I've surveyed these cases since the end of the Cold War, is that in most cases, governments find other ways of responding when this is an enormously provocative attack. For example, actually, simple law enforcement is actually the most common response. In a sense that they simply try to go through legal channels at home and abroad to find out who did it, catch them eventually, might take years, and bring them back and put them on trial. Often governments change their laws at home, often to criminalize more facets of terrorist activity, various conspiratorial activities, possession of firearms. In the United States, material support for terrorism. In other words, they increase their abilities in terms of just domestic law enforcement to deal with the issue rather than trying to retaliate through some sort of coercive or a military means. Now, these kinds of measures can be extremely severe. For example, a common response is to put a group on a list of terrorist organizations. This then comports automatic sanctions that prevents them from raising money in your country, for example, among a diaspora population. So non-military responses can still be quite punitive and less risky for the state.
Let's go over to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus with Martha Crenshaw.
Good morning. Yeah, state terror was one of the topics I wanted you to address, and you've already talked about how you that's not your specialty, but I wanted to point out that our state terrorist, Efren Rios Montt in Guatemala, is actually on trial. Apparently, it's the first time a general, and he was also president for a while, first time a president country is being adjudicated in his own country. And it's a credit to the stalwart Mayans who were genocide.